In the year 2007, the Lord came unto Noah, who was now living in the United States, and said, "Once again the earth has become wicked and overpopulated, and I see the end of all flesh before me. Build another ark and save two of every living thing, along with a few good humans." He gave Noah the blueprint, saying, "You have 6 months to build the ark before I will start the rain for 40 days and 40 nights." 6 months later, the Lord looked down and saw Noah weeping in his yard, but no ark. "Noah," he said, "I'm about to start the rain. Where is the ark?" "Forgive me, Lord," begged Noah, "but things have changed. I needed a building permit. I've been arguing with the inspector about the need for a sprinkler system. My neighbors claim I violated the zoning laws by building the ark in my yard and exceeding height limitations. Then the transportation department demanded a bond be posted for the future costs of moving power lines and other overhead obstructions to clear the passage for the ark to be moved to the sea. I told them the sea would be coming to us, but they would hear nothing of it. When I started gathering the animals, an animal rights group sued me. They insisted I was confining wild animals against their will and argued the accommodation was too restrictive and was cruel and inhumane. Then the EPA ruled that I couldn't build the ark until they conducted an environmental impact study. The trade unions say I can't use my sons. They insist I have to hire only union workers with ark building experience. To make matters worse, the IRS seized all my assets, claiming I'm about to leave the country with illegally with endangered species. So forgive me, Lord, but it would take at least 10 years for me to finish this ark. Suddenly the skies cleared, the sun began to shine, and a rainbow stretched across the sky. Noah looked up in wonder and said, "You mean you're not going to destroy the world?" "No," said the Lord, "the government beat me to it." Well, our discussion this morning is render unto Caesar. And in America, we have a kind of an indoor sport of, you know, griping about government, although all you have to do is travel outside the country and come back and the stars and stripes look pretty good, don't they? And so we have the challenge of living as business people, professional people, or organizers of independent ministries with this agency called the IRS. And this morning I want to just make you aware of some of the challenges we face, some of the things we need to be thinking about in order to make that interface as comfortable as possible. The novelist Herman Wouk once wrote that income tax returns are the most imaginative fiction being written today. Commissioner of Internal Revenue Mark Everson in 2004 put it this way: "The IRS must deter those inclined to evade their tax obligations and pursue those who actually do. Enforcement will be a principal responsibility of the IRS, and we must bring a laser-like focus to it." That was his perception. In consequence of the commissioner's plans and perception, the IRS has entered into a strategic plan, five-year plan, 2005 to 2009. And basically, here's the problem that the IRS and that the country face. Every year, there is a tax shortfall. That is to say, the difference between what people really owe in taxes and what they pay of $345 billion. That comes close to taking care of the budget deficit. What the IRS collects is, as I recall, about $55 billion. Which leaves an available $290 billion from the government's perspective of untapped resources. Now, enter the five-year plan of the IRS. They intend to ramp up enforcement and audit activities, and they're going to do so on four basic levels. And let me write up here, first of all, arrearage or deficiency. They're going to intensively audit to see if they can't close that tax gap to some extent. Number two, they're going to be going after tax professionals, accountants, attorneys, other individuals who were involved in either tax preparation or tax advice. Number three, they're going to very aggressively pursue what they see to be improper illegal and possibly criminal activity, a lot of it involved in offshore transfer of funds. And then finally, and here's the one that will be of concern to many of us here, they're going to ramp up enforcement on tax-exempt organizations. And we'll be talking to some extent in detail about that in just a few minutes. All right, let's go through those very quickly. And the handouts I've given you, the second staple set of handouts you will see, is a letter from the Senate to Don Korb, who is the chief counsel for the IRS, who, by the way, is going to be coming out to a tax seminar that our firm is putting on in Berkeley just early next month, and we'll be giving the keynote address for that. Also, they're addressing Commissioner Everson, and one of the things you'll notice in that letter is that they're concerned about tax abuses in tax-exempt entities. So be aware that the service is intensively going to be looking over exempt organizations, that is your 501c3 organizations, to be sure that they are doing what they need to do and that there isn't improper diversion of taxes through exempt organizations that the service believes should otherwise be collected. All right, let's talk about these in detail. First of all, with respect to tax deficiencies, the IRS, to deter noncompliance, is in the process of adjusting its audit process. They have computers now that talk to each other, much more so than before 9/11. And various agencies are, in fact, now talking to each other. The IRS computers are much more sophisticated. They have ways to detect whereby patterns are not necessarily normal in a tax return. And those are the ones that are oftentimes selected for audit and for enforcement proceedings. You will notice the graph charts that I gave you there, and I'll hold one up for those of you who may not have access to it. In 96, there began to be a trend downward in enforcement revenue. It's coming sharply upward again toward fiscal year 2005. And you notice all of the graphs predominantly took a dip around 1999-2000 in terms of IRS audits and enforcement. That's starting back up. Commissioner Everson is very concerned about the possibility of taxes that are in fact owed not being paid. Advances in computer technology are going to help them in doing that. Let me describe for you now the process by which the IRS will in fact take a look at you. If in fact your return or your organization or business return is sent out for audit, you'll be getting a notification from the service from an auditor of either a field audit where they come to your business or your organization, or an office audit where you bring your records into them. If it's an office audit, typically they have one or two issues they're not quite sure about. If you can bring the records in, do so. If you have the chance to bring records in, and there's nothing in there that involves the Fifth Amendment, if you know what I mean, okay, don't make that mistake. If you've honestly attempted to comply with the tax code and regulations, bring your records in and drown them in records. Taxing entities love paper. The more paper they see, the more inclined they are to understand that what you did was in fact proper and that you have documentation to prove it. My father-in-law one time was routinely audited. And one time the auditor came in, and he had a stack of papers that deep. Actually, I think it was his brother, my wife's uncle. And the auditor took one look at that and said, no, that's okay, I'll take your word for it. No, he said, you wanted to come in and see these, I want you to go through every one of these sheets of paper. The audit terminated favorably for him. So if you have records, be sure to bring them in and keep good records. That's your best safeguard in terms of an IRS audit. If when the audit takes place, there are two agents instead of one, there's your red flag. Call your lawyer, because one of them is probably from what we call CID, Criminal Investigation Division. They think something funny is going on. Now, this can happen to Ed. It happened to me. I closed out a CD one year. The bank stupidly reported the entire corpus of the account as income. I didn't report it as income. When I went in for an office audit, on the wall behind the examiner's desk was Criminal Investigations Division. I knew he was after something. He thought, stank. When I produced, you know, the records of the deposit and showed that the bank had made a mistake, his face visibly relaxed. Then he proceeded to challenge me on a trip that I had made, I think, to New Zealand for an independent ministry. I'd spoken down there for them because they were short of funds. I had paid my own way and deducted it, which I was entitled to do. He said, wait a minute, you can't do that. I said, you know, you might want to just check the following reg. And I gave him one point, you know, the regulation. He disappeared down the hall, came back shaking his head. He said, okay, but don't do it again. Okay. So if there are two of them, do call your lawyer. All right. The audit proceeds, and many of you have been through this, but for those of you who haven't, let me very, very quickly summarize what happens in an audit proceeding. It seems very strange to be at an ASI meeting in front of Adventists doing what is basically a secular thing. I've just almost never done it, but this thing really is where we live. And particularly for the sake of our exempt organizations, our 501c3s, I want to just kind of alert you to some areas where you can steer clear of trouble, and you should, because why should the Lord's work get messed up in mistakes that are avoidable? All right, you're referred out for audit, either field or office audit. You will either agree with the auditor or you will disagree. Let's assume you disagree. He or she finds things that they feel, you know, should have been subject to tax. You can then take that thing to appeals. And at the appeals level of the IRS, you have much more senior people. Many times the auditors may be fairly junior. Sometimes they're fairly senior. We have some clients now with 401k plans where when we got the audit letter, it's from a guy who's really senior and he's mean. And that changes the kind of advice we give to the client. You know, you watch it. But a lot of times the auditor may be fairly junior. The appeals officers are able to do things that the auditor may not be able to do. They can make adjustments. They can make concessions. They see things from a more seasoned perspective. When you go to appeals, and we're dealing with on appeals now on a number of matters where you can talk with a very, very senior, very experienced individual who knows the code and knows the regs and can make adjustments. Sometimes these guys can't. There are certain enforcement issues the IRS is pursuing now that have to go to the national office. They've got to go to Washington, and even the appeals officers have to get approval from Washington before they can make a concession. There are some penalties now that you can inadvertently step into in a retirement plan for which even the commissioner, only the commissioner, can reverse the penalty, and some of them he can't reverse. Congress has really tightened up. So you go to appeals. You argue the thing out. If that doesn't work, you will wind up ultimately with a determination letter, which is called a 30-day letter, in which the auditor basically says, we find our preliminary findings, our RAR, is that you owe extra dollars in taxes. Now, at this point, when you get the 30-day letter, you certainly have recourse to appeals with respect to that. There's no clock ticking yet. You're still talking to the service. Many times they will want to have you sign a consent to extend the statute of limitations. Usually you can do that. What that means is that the statute of limitations, which normally starts running on the day your tax return is due and ends 3 years later, will be extended. If you don't extend the statute voluntarily, the service is now under pressure and they have to then determine a deficiency or they get told by the statute. So within that 3-year period, if you don't extend the statute, what you'll do is force them to issue you a letter of deficiency. If none of this stuff works, the next thing you get from the service is a 90-day letter, which basically is a determination that you are deficient in your taxes. That 90-day letter means exactly what it says. It gives you 90 days to file a petition with the tax court. If you don't get that petition on file with the tax court on or before the 90th day, you're out of luck. What's your option then? You got to pay the tax in full, pay all the penalties and interest the service may have asserted against you, and then sue in a federal district court for refund. Now, does that sound like an easy or pleasant thing to do? No. So, if you get a 90-day letter, you have 90 days to go to the tax court, and it doesn't mean 91 days. Once you file a petition with the tax court, then you can go back to appeals. You're now talking with an attorney who's part of the IRS system, you once again can negotiate this thing. Once you get before the tax court, you have plenty of time. Be careful filing a petition with the tax court if it's frivolous, if it doesn't have merit, if you're just obviously trying to stall. That tax court judge can sanction you with big bucks, and they do. My son clerked for a judge on the tax court for a year, and every once in a while a judge will get his or her back up and say, this taxpayer has no point bringing this to the court, wasting our time, and there will be a monetary sanction. So in addition to the tax you owe, now you owe the tax court money. See? So be a little careful. Be sure your argument has merit there. All right, let's assume that all this stuff fails and you ultimately wind up with a deficiency. The IRS has said and made stick the idea that you owe them money. What happens next? Well, now the process becomes just kind of a slow-moving dinosaur. And it takes a while. The service takes a while getting around to these things. But ultimately, their computers will decide that your time has come. You will start to get bills from them. The first you get will just be bills, monthly statement. You owe us the following amount of taxes, penalties, if any, and interest. If you ignore those bills, and many of our clients do, you then go to a notice of intent to levy. What does that mean? It means that anything you own under that Social Security number is fair game for the service. They will take your house if they want to. There's no homestead exemption. California, you can declare a homestead and keep a certain amount of your house safe from creditors. There's no homestead exemption with respect to the IRS. They can and will take your house. Now then, when you get a notice of intent a notice of lien. They will impose a lien. They'll record a lien against you, and then the next thing will be a notice of intent to levy. All right. When they record a lien against you, what do you suppose that does to your credit rating? It brings you, down from the 800 level for sure. You may not be able to get a loan. You sure can't get a loan against your house, even to pay off the IRS. So then you've got to go to the IRS and say, look, I see the light. I really want to give you this money. More than anything in this world, I want to give you this money. You can go to the IRS through their special procedures operations, and they will lift the lien or subordinate it to the lender on the explicit understanding that when the loan proceeds come out, guess where they go? Into Uncle Sam's pocket. So once your notice of lien is recorded against you, your options begin to narrow. Now, you do have one. It's called a Section 6320 hearing. The taxpayer's Bill of Rights has built into the system some safeguards, so if you feel like you've been unfairly dealt with, you can bring petitions. Section 6320 of the code says that if the lien has been improperly entered, you have a right to bring a petition under that section, and you can take that petition, if you want to the tax court. Uniformly, those things are not looked on with favor by the tax court. If the service has made a major mistake, yeah, they'll grant you your relief. But my son said he saw plenty of them there. Very rarely were they even given the time of day. So once you get a notice of lien, you theoretically have the right to bring a petition that the lien was improperly recorded against you. While that thing is being heard, it stays all proceedings. The IRS can't take a thing. Okay? If you don't do that, you get a notice of intent to levy, which means that very shortly they will be pursuing your house, your bank accounts, or whatever. You have a chance there under Section 6330 to bring, again, objection that the levy was improperly noticed, and you can once again take it to the tax court, oftentimes with disappointing results. They routinely reject them. Okay. What if all of these remedies fail, and you are left owing Uncle Sam a chunk of change, and you just can't afford to pay it? What's the option? Now, have you noticed there's a growth industry on cable TV of people saying you can settle for pennies on the dollar? Have you seen those ads? Well, there is a way where you can file an offer in compromise with the IRS. The problem is that a lot of these have become growth industries for lawyers who see it as a cash cow. Without mentioning names, I have in the office seen and repaired some of the disasters performed by these people. I saw one client had paid $3,000 to get a relatively simple IRS form filled out. It wasn't done properly. When the IRS said, "We're rejecting your offer and compromise," this televised lawyer then sent them a letter of 4 pages, on each page of which at least twice was said, "We've done all the work we promised to do and we resign." $3,000 easy bucks. So be careful. But an offer in compromise is possible if, in fact, you really can't afford it. If you're in business, you fill out one set of financial forms. If you're just a personal taxpayer, you fill out another set. There's another possibility, and that is you can offer to do an installment agreement whereby you pay your tax off over time, and you have to fill out a financial form that discloses to the revenue officer what your assets are. So these are your options. Try to settle for less than you owe, and you really have to be hurting financially. And once again, they will consider the equity in your house as being available for payment of your taxes. If you can pay all the taxes, but you can't do it just immediately, try to do an installment agreement. Now, what do you suppose might be the single most important element in making these kind of arrangements work? You need to have a decent working relationship with the revenue officer of the IRS who is assigned to your case. You need to treat them with respect. Treat them as human beings. Most of them are very, very decent people. I've discovered in our practice, we really try to let the revenue officers know that if we represent something to them, they can take it to the bank. It's true. We're not playing games with them. We will do what we represent we will do. Let me give you an example. In California, I have a taxpayer that owes a huge amount of money to the Employment Development Department for unpaid employee taxes. I have worked with this revenue officer before. He's up in Fresno. He knows me. I know him. We respect each other. We treat each other with respect. We don't do each other favors necessarily because it's a professional relationship, but at least we have a situation of mutual respect. One day I called him up and I said, "My taxpayer is ready to throw the towel in. He, with his ex-partner, owes certain amounts of money. He's willing to put a mortgage on his house, pay you off." You know what the revenue officer said to me? He said, "Lou, just hang on a second. Have him continue to make his little monthly payments. He's shown good faith. I'm working this from another angle. He doesn't say anything to me. He doesn't have to. What he's doing is going after the partner who was really at fault. He's giving my guy the chance to defer payment until the partner who's really at fault gets hit hard." Okay? So if you deal with IRS personnel in an adversarial way, in a disrespectful way, you'll get back what you give. If you treat them as the human beings that most of them are, they're most of them very decent people, although they're doing a very tough job, you'll get a very different relationship. And I suggest that, you know, that's the kind of thing as Christians we probably would want to do anyway, even though we may see them as being very, very wrong on a tax issue. Okay. Now then, this is the process then by which the IRS is going to tighten things up and examine returns and determine whether they can get some of that $290 billion missing dollars every year. Let's move to point number two, criminal law. And that's something I don't have to dwell on at length here, except to say sadly that I have had some Adventists call me who had gotten into, I think, bad advice and gone into the posture of tax protesters saying, "You know, you really don't owe this tax. It's unconstitutional." To which I respond, "If you really believe the income tax is unconstitutional, can you do this?" Because that's what's going to happen next. They come looking to put bracelets on you. The IRS is very, very hostile to people in a tax protesting situation. Abusive tax schemes, programs, bankruptcy fraud, corporate fraud, employment tax enforcement is an area where they're moving into criminal prosecutions. Easy to fall into that. Supposing you have somebody that you say, "Well, he sure seems to me like an independent contractor. He's not an employee. He's an independent contractor, so I'm not going to pay withholding for him or FICA or FUTA or any of the other things." The IRS comes along and says, we have this list of common law ideas by which we determine if he's an independent contractor or an employee of yours. If they determine him to be an employee, guess what? Bingo, you owed all of that stuff that you should have been withholding and remitting to the government. If they determine that this is, in fact, something that was done with criminal intent, you can be facing a far worse problem than just a civil tax liability. And bear in mind that trust fund payments, that is to say the withholding, you know, that you employers do from your employees' paychecks every 2 weeks, then you have to remit to the government. If you fail to do that, if you don't remit the taxes you withheld, even if you're doing business in a corporate form, the corporation is liable for those. You, as a corporate officer, are liable for those. You, as the individual who had the prerogative of cutting the checks and making payments, are liable individually and jointly. And that one you don't get rid of in bankruptcy. Some tax debts you do. If you fail to remit withheld payroll taxes, it survives bankruptcy and you're still liable. And there are significant penalties attached to that also with respect to not remitting tax withheld. So the IRS is going after a total of about 16 different areas where they think that criminal activity may be involved. Employment tax enforcement is one area where they do. Furthermore, they're going after what they call abusive tax shelters. Now, you've all heard the term. My father-in-law kept on his desk a cute little thing. It's a wooden vase with four little pegs and a little roof over it. And underneath the roof were some tax driven into it. And when the IRS would come, he would say, this is the only tax shelter I own. Okay. What is a tax shelter? We hear the term bandied about. It's a real no-no for the IRS. It'll get them their hackles up quick. But what is the thing? Real simply, a tax shelter is something that has no independent economic purpose. Except to do what? Save taxes. Now, we say, well, don't we do that all the time? Don't we do things to save taxes? But ask yourself, does it have an independent economic purpose? Now, when we pay our tithe, as we should, we do what? We save taxes. But there's an independent purpose for tithe apart from just getting our taxes lowered. It's the moral obligation we feel to the Lord. There are investments a business will make, like buying new equipment. You can either expense that under 179 or you can depreciate it. That'll save you taxes, but there's a business purpose because you need the machinery, right? But there are certain transactions that are entered into that really don't have any business purpose or benefit to you. They merely give rise to tax benefits. Let me give you an example. Participation in a tax indifferent party transaction. Now, what am I talking about? Where a party is indifferent to taxes, it means that taxes aren't a problem for them. What would be a perfect example of that? Your non-profit entity. Nonprofits don't pay taxes. So therefore, if you enter into a transaction where the income that would otherwise be taxed to you is absorbed by a charitable entity and there's no economic purpose for that, it's a tax shelter. What happens when you enter into a tax shelter? Well, the IRS from time to time looks over all of the fancy schemes people come up with and they promulgate a list. This we don't like, this we don't like, this we don't like. They have a whole list of things they don't like. And they're called listed transactions because they're on a list. One of them is the Section 412I Life Insurance Funded Retirement Plan, which some of you may be in. And on Friday the 13th of 2004, the service just had enough of this because there are ways in which 412Is can be abused. There's no economic purpose for it except to save taxes the way the things are set up. The IRS said we're going to make these listed transactions. Well, you're in a 412I, you never saw it happen. You didn't know from Friday the 13th, you know, it was just Friday. And we're getting ready for Sabbath and thank the Lord the week is over. Your 412I went on a list. You didn't do anything about it. The moment that thing went on a list, you were required to file a form with the IRS disclosing that you had this thing. And a very senior IRS official told my son, when you file one of those things, you might as well write audit me in red across the top, because that's what's going to happen. Now then, you didn't file the form disclosing you're in what the IRS calls a listed transaction. What happens next? Nothing, unless I get audited. Wait a second. Congress looked this thing over and said, if you fail to file the required form reporting a listed transaction, the penalty for a corporation is a fine or an excise tax of $50,000. It can go to $200,000, which means over a period of years, that thing pyramids. And there are certain penalties in the IRS system, particularly having to do with pension plans, that every year it's deemed to be a new transaction. So it doubles and it goes up like an exponent and the curve goes like this. And I've got a client now that theoretically owes $1.2 million, simply because of a very innocent mistake made years ago in a retirement plan. So abusive tax shelters are things where the IRS will say, you should have reported this thing. We made it clear in our public promulgations that you should and you didn't do it. And now that comes down to the second point where we're listing. Number one, the IRS is tightening up enforcement. Number two, they're tightening up on tax professionals, lawyers and accountants and others. Well, I'm speaking here, you know, mainly to people that don't practice transactional or confrontational tax law. But there may be some lawyers here who do domestic relations work or estate planning or real estate or accountants who deal with these things. The IRS promulgated a thing called Circular 230, and it says, basically, that if you are a tax professional, you cannot give advice designed solely to lessen taxes without a proper business purpose. Something else you can't do. You can't give an opinion on whether you're going to be audited. Now, I get emails from clients, you know, if I do this, can I fly under the audit radar? Well, you know what my response is? I cannot answer that question. I would not purport to answer that question. If I were to answer that question, if I were to tell a client, if you do this, the chances are real slim you're going to get audited. And the IRS finds out about it, I'm up before their ethics committee like that. I can no longer practice before them. Now, how can a domestic relations lawyer back into a tax problem? Real simple. We have repaired property settlements done between divorcing spouses by a divorce lawyer who may be superb in family law, knows nothing about tax law. There's been an inadvertent problem with respect to the way taxes are allocated. That individual can back unknowingly into a Circular 230 problem. Same thing with accountants. So be really, really careful. Don't ever ask your tax advisor, how do I avoid going to audit? Because if they're at all concerned about their professional future, they cannot answer they can't answer the question. Audit numbers are up. Imposition of penalties in many instances is mandatory. And the sophistication of the service in determining who may be likely to fulfill this tax gap is significantly growing. Now let's talk about nonprofits. You have in your hand the letter from the Senate Finance Committee with respect to nonprofit organizations. This is one that I'm really concerned about, very concerned, because in Adventism we operate in nonprofit organizations totally, inside the church and with independent ministries. There are some real traps you can fall into. And let me put on the board here some of the areas in which you can unintentionally get in kind of a difficult position with respect to the Internal Revenue Service. When a nonprofit is found founded, there is frequently a major donor. That's oftentimes how this happens. An individual sees a need within the church, says, I want to fill that need, I'm going to fund it. With the dollars, frequently comes the idea, not illogically at all, that the donor would kind of like to have a little oversight as to how that money is used. Makes sense. If you're going to donate a bunch of money, you'd kind of like to have some supervision. All right, the other individuals here that will be at issue will be managers and board members. Now then, how could you get in trouble with a thing like this? Well, the manager is going to be hiring people. The manager, in all likelihood, is an employee as well. This individual can't afford to work for nothing. They've got to support their family. So dollars will be coming to the manager. Dollars will be coming to the employees. Now, think about it a second. If you're the IRS looking at this thing, this is a tax-exempt entity, presumably formed up under subsection 3, 501C, is there any way that this could be abused? How? Excess compensation. Is there any other way this thing can be abused? It's usually a very close group of people, friends, brothers and sisters in the church, many times family. You can hire relatives. Okay? Or kids. What else could you do? You could pay your board members. They could be paid, yeah. The money could flow there. What about, pardon? Be the treasurer. Yeah, as an officer of this thing, you can. What about rental property? You can rent property to the foundation. What if, for example, I'm the donor and I get to thinking, wait a second, I can get some of that back. I'll rent the building the foundation's in. Or I'll make a loan to the foundation and get interest back. You see the areas where conflict of interest now comes in? Now, in a reasonable factual situation, there could be no intent to do any wrong here, yet you could still find yourself technically in violation. Why? Because 501C3 provides that no substantial amount of the earnings or property of that exempt organization shall inure, that's the magic word, shall inure to any private individual. That means you can't suck money out for private benefit. This is supposed to go to the public under sections 509, A1, A2, or A3, depending on which kind of entity you are. Now, as soon as this begins to be diverted to conduits through which it conceivably can flow back to the benefit of private individuals, at least the IRS's ears go up. Okay? There is a possibility of private inurement. There's also the possibility of what the IRS calls excess benefit. That is to say, you get more out of your rental proceeds than the property is really worth on the marketplace. It's worth $500 a month, you're getting $750. That's excess benefit. Okay? Now, the IRS is starting to take this thing very seriously. There's what's called compliance checks. The first phase of this thing were compliance checks of 1,200 tax-exempt organizations. What they're doing is they're going through the books and records looking for this kind of activity. Most of this involves record keeping and information reporting. By the way, have you ever heard of a Form 990? Form 990 is the form that an exempt organization is supposed to file every year with the IRS. If you're a church, you don't have to. If you're an entity that's deemed to be a part of the church, query, you may not have to. They're very, very reluctant. The service is very reluctant to mess with churches, although they will, as was seen in the Bob Jones case, for example. But you need to file your 990s. Now, on Forms 990, guess what you are required to report now? the compensation of your managers and key individuals. All right? Furthermore, the IRS is doing a number of single-issue audits. There are going to be one thing they focus in on, such as compensation of managers. They did 1,200 audits of tax-exempt entities. They're doing 600 single-purpose audits looking for some specific issue. What they're doing is they're fishing. They're probing in the exempt community, trying to find out where the weak points are, trying to find out where abuse is taking place from their perspective. In May of 2006, they launched another phase of this thing. Another 250 tax-exempt organizations were specifically looked at with respect to compensation issues. Okay? Now, does that mean that an exempt organization can't hire people? No, that doesn't mean that at all. Does that mean that people working for an exempt organization should have to work for less money than somebody doing a comparable job in the public sector? No, that's not what that means. The service has explicitly said you don't have to work for less, but don't work for more. So how are you going to check it out? Well, the wise thing to do when you talk about manager compensation is to develop a compensation committee on your board. It should be independent from the board. We're going to be getting into Sarbanes-Oxley in just a few minutes. We're beginning to see where you want to compartmentalize. The board is over here, and these oversight committees are separate so that they're not deemed to be within the command influence of the board. The compensation committee will do what? If they're doing their job, they'll go out, do a little bit of research, and there are research engines available on the internet and so forth, where you find out the job description of the person you're hiring or have hired, comparable individuals doing the same kind of work out in the private sector, and you do a study and you say the salary ranges from here to here, okay? And if your compensation falls within that salary range, typically, the IRS will say, you've done your homework, we're satisfied with that. That's not excessive benefit, it's not private inurement, there's not a problem. I strongly urge against rental arrangements. They can be done. If you're very, very clear that you've demonstrated that the rent that the exempt entity is paying is fair at or below market value, you certainly have a strong argument on audit. It's a whole lot cleaner if you don't get involved with a donor or a board member or a manager renting something they own to the entity. That just raises all kinds of flags. Same thing with loans. I've seen various opinions on this. Some say if the interest is reasonable, it's okay. I've seen other opinions where they say don't touch it. Don't loan money to a nonprofit where you are a significantly involved individual, a donor, a manager, a board member. Now, where does a donor get to be a disqualified individual? If the amount of money you have donated equals 2% of all the money that that foundation has taken in over its lifetime, you become a disqualified person, okay? And you can't then engage in these transactions with respect to yourself. Now, why am I concerned about this? Well, I'm concerned because there's a section in the Internal Revenue Code called Section 4958. This one has teeth in it. It imposes excise taxes on disqualified people, the donor in excess of 2%, the manager, the board members, any interested individuals. Any person who, during the five-year period preceding the audit, had the capacity to influence the spending or other major decisions of the organization. Any family member of a person like that. Any voting member of the organization's governing body. Any president, chief executive, the person who founded the organization, and the person who is a substantial contributor, that is, more than 2% of total contributions. Those are disqualified individuals who can't engage in these transactions. How do you recognize when a transaction may be in question? Too much compensation, too much rent, loans, any interest-bearing loan, etc. And retained interest. What if the guy who or gal who gives money to the organization says, okay, I'm going to give you this property, but I retain the right to have it revert to my grandchildren at my death? Retained interest. that taints it. In other words, that's a retained interest which will also be deemed to be a transaction with a disqualified individual. Okay? Moving very quickly now, what does Section 4958 say? If any of these no-nos occur, they impose what they call intermediate sanctions. Why do they call them intermediate? Because the only other sanction they can do is what? Say, you're not acting like a tax-exempt entity anymore. We're taking away your 501c3 status. That's the nuclear option. You mess up too bad with an exempt organization, the service always has the right to say 501c3 is gone, you're no longer exempt. Now you're a taxable entity, you're required to account for income, and then they retroactively go back looking for income from the time when they think the events occurred that caused this disqualification. Well, Congress said, wait a second. It isn't every organization that makes a mistake that ought to just have the rug pulled out from under them. So what we're going to do is we're going to have what we call intermediate sanctions. That is to say monetary sanctions. You still keep your 501c3, although you're probably going to get audited again real soon. But meanwhile, here's what we're going to do. For a disqualified person, that is to say a board member or donor, who engages in an excess benefit transaction, phase one of the penalty is 25% initial excise tax on what they got. That removes a lot of your incentive to do this stuff. You don't correct it, the service comes back, and this time they're hopping mad, and the excise tax is 200% of your benefit. Now you really have a disincentive for doing any of this stuff. If you're a foundation manager, you get a 10% tax. This is the guy here who they say, okay, he's under the command influence of the donor or the board, but he's not as culpable, he or she is not as culpable, so therefore we're going to impose a 10% tax with a $10,000 limit. So my strong advice to you is look your boards over, look your conflict of interest statements over. By the way, when you form a new one, some of you may be planning on forming a new tax exempt. You'll be filing Form 1028 with the service. That's the one that you fill out and say, I want to be tax exempt. Here's all about me. Now give me my letter from the district director saying that I'm exempt under 501c3. The new ones, the new 1028s, require you to specify your conflict of interest policy. And it's my understanding they also probe into remuneration of key individuals. So be really, really careful about that. All right, let's. What is our time frame here? When does this session end? Now? I didn't bring a program up here. 15? 30. So it's supposed to end at 10:30? All right. 10:15? Okay. Let's talk a little bit about unrelated business income. You've heard this term? If you're operating what time? 10:15. So let's be quick about this. Unrelated business income is what? You're a tax-exempt entity, but you're doing something that generates income. Well, praise the Lord. We wish we could do more of that, don't we? But if it is not directly related to your exempt purpose, that is to say, if you're doing something that's in competition with the private sector, it can be deemed to be unrelated business income. You can be taxed on it. You do too much of that, you can lose your 501c3, because they're saying basically you pretend to be tax exempt, but you're actually a for-profit institution. There's the challenge you face, and the best way that I can give you a little feel for unrelated business income is to give you some examples of things that the IRS has said is okay and some examples of things they said weren't okay. And that'll kind of get you a little feel for what unrelated business income is all about. They have held that it's okay if you're a hospital and you lease office space to a hospital-based medical group. That's related to your provision of healthcare services to the community. That's okay. Operation of a hospital cafeteria, even though it may be in competition with Joe's Diner down the block, is still held to be okay because it's related to providing a service to those involved in your employ and the patients you're seeing. Same thing with a parking lot and a gift shop. Those are all okay. Performance of laboratory testing by an exempt hospital on specimens furnished by staff physicians. Oh, wait a second. That's beginning to sound like any physician could bring, you know, a lab, you know, pathology specimen and want your lab to do work on it, even though there's a lab down the street. The IRS has taken the position that's okay if they are staff physicians because you're furthering the hospital's educational program. Okay? Operation of vending machines on campus by an exempt university. That's okay. That's incidental to providing for student needs. A museum sale of greeting card reproductions of artworks. You're a museum, you have pictures on the wall, you sell greeting cards with little copies of those pictures. That's been held by the service to be okay. A vocational school sale of articles made by its students, held to be okay. I remember out at Soquel camp meeting, one of our Native American schools in Arizona brought out some just beautiful pottery done by the kids there. And I thought to myself, wow, these kids deserve better than to see this stuff coming back in a box. And every piece that wasn't sold, I bought, because I wanted those kids to know they were appreciated, you know? Well, now the IRS will take a look at that and say, fine, what you're doing is you're furthering your exempt purpose because your students are making these things and you're making them available to the public. That's directly related to what you're doing. Here's one that's kind of interesting. Conduct of horse auctions by a 501c5. You know, C3 ain't the only one. There's about 29 or 30 of them, different exempt organizations you can be. A C5 was an agricultural association promoting horse breeding. Conduct of horse auctions by a C5 was held to be okay. It wasn't unrelated business income. All those examples I gave you, the service would look at them and say, fine, you don't owe tax on this. This is incidental to your exempt purpose. Now, can you think of one? You are an independent ministry, and you produce books supportive of the Adventist faith, and you sell them. Unrelated business income? It depends. Presbyterian and Reformed Publishing Company lost their tax exemption even though they eloquently argued they were supporting the Presbyterian Church. You know why? Because their publishing efforts were so large, so commercial, made so much money. They lost it. Now, the small publisher, I think you'd probably be okay. It depends on the extent to which you look like a for-profit institution. Let me give you some examples of ones that didn't make the cut. Unrelated activities held to constitute unrelated taxable income. Sale of pharmaceuticals to non-patients by a hospital's pharmacy. You're not a patient there. You come in off the street. They sell you a prescription. IRS says that's not related to your exempt purpose. They weren't a patient of yours. You follow what I'm saying? Incidental testing of non-patient specimens. There is the hospital lab that was fine as long as it was doing it for staff physicians and inpatients. But you start bringing specimens in from off the street, and the IRS says now the whole ball game's changed. You see how facts and circumstances kind of tilt those pans in one direction or another? Here's one that I find interesting. It was a place that was building housing for people in need, but they built 80 houses within 18 months. The service says that is just too commercial for us. If they had built one, probably they'd have gotten by with it. Okay? Sale of scientific books and city souvenirs by a folk art museum. If they had been selling folk art, it would have been fine. They're selling city souvenirs and maps that have nothing to do with folk art. The IRS says we get off the bus at this point. Sale of advertising space in an exempt college's yearbook. Unrelated business income. And finally, the school's an exempt organization, use of its tennis facilities during the summer as a public tennis club. Unrelated business income. Be careful of it. It's something your accountant will work with you on, but if you're an exempt organization, you're selling any product, ask yourself, does this thing defensively relate to my exempt purpose for being? All right, let's talk about Sarbanes-Oxley. Rusty did a magnificent little piece in the ASI magazine. I really appreciate that kind of focus We as Adventists ought to have our business affairs clear and well done like Daniel. You look them over with a critical looking glass, no mistake can be made. Amen. Thank the Lord. I was really pleased when I saw Rusty's excellent piece. Let me give you a quick rundown on Sarbanes-Oxley with respect to tax exempts. Two of them are specifically, two provisions of SOX are specifically aimed at not only for-profit but non-profit. Number one, you can't fire a whistleblower. Some employee says you did something against the law, you fire them, and you're in a SOX complaint. And that individual can file an independent suit, but they take it first to the Department of Labor. And DOL gets into this thing, or OSHA actually is the entity that handles these things, strange enough to say OSHA jumps in with their attorneys. Now you're facing a federal agency. Don't fire a whistleblower, even if you think their claim is totally non-meritorious. Number two, if an investigation is underway, if you come under audit, don't shred any documents. I have never done that in my life. I strongly urge you against it. Retain documents because they're your best defense. You realize that there is no statute of limitations on some tax things? For fraud, if the IRS says fraud has existed, there is no statute of limitations. You could have done it in 86. If you don't have records to establish what you did, you're going to wind up wishing you had them. So, I don't throw stuff away, but that's up to you. At least keep them for 4 years. There can be 6-year statute of limitations in certain tax issues. I think it's better to keep them for 7, but I just generally don't throw anything away. All right. In 2004, the Senate Finance Committee made some proposals. Restrictions on governing board compensation. They were thinking about that. They were talking about mandatory audits for organizations over $250,000 in annual revenue, and that's a lot of tax exempts make that much. Mandatory audits. They were proposing a SOX 404 certification by CEOs. Without getting into the details of this, 404 requires the CEO of a for-profit company to certify certain things that they have done to fit the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. They're talking about making that applicable to tax exempts. And finally, new governing board rules. In other words, oversight of board members. Now, in 2004, Congress was looking that over. They didn't wind up doing it, but be aware that there is thought out there of doing it. Some states are beginning to. California is beginning to import in state law certain portions analogous to Sarbanes-Oxley and other states. New York, I think the Attorney General thought about it, tried about it, then backed off, but these things are certainly in the works. Your 1023, whereby you apply for a tax-exempt organization, now because of the influence of Sarbanes-Oxley, has a conflict of interest statement questionnaire. You've got to put in it what your conflict of interest statement is and have one. Go back, if you don't have one, draw one up and make it conform to federal tax law. They also require you to give detailed information on compensations of executives and consultants. Very, very quickly, what are some tax-exempt entities doing now because they kind of see the way the wind is blowing? Many of them are now developing audit committees with appointment of compensation and oversight responsibility with an external auditor. One thing companies do is they'll have an auditor from a certain accounting firm operate for a couple of years, then they switch auditors so that mistakes can't become perpetuated, so that a second set of eyes will detect errors. That's not a bad plan to do. A lot of tax exempts are now doing pre-approval of audit and non-audit services. They're having executive sessions with management, the internal auditor, and the external auditor. In other words, watch where your money's going. Watch how you're spending it. Watch what your paper trail is. Watch how you document the legitimacy of every dollar you take in, from where, and every dollar you spend. And I might say in conclusion, it's really, really important with your 501c3s, get as broad as possible a range of donors. Because the IRS and the federal government look very, very critically at entities where there is just a very, very small group of insider donors. You run the risk under those circumstances of being reclassified as a private foundation. Then you got annual tax. Then you have really tough rules on insider transactions. It's a whole new ballgame. To keep your public charity status under 501c3, get as broad-based as possible donations from the general public. That's what the government's looking for. That's what they like to see. So audits are a big area where 501c3s are trying to anticipate where the federal government's regulations are going to go. Independent audit committees, certified financial statements, a conflict of interest statement, and full disclosure of what you're doing. Believe me, if you don't do it, the federal government will wind up doing it for you. Okay, it's 10:16. I'm sorry we had to race through this stuff, but time is up.
Well, let me ask you to look at your program schedule. We have just a couple more minutes.
Sure.
We actually had a misprint here, and I'm sorry I wasn't here to point that out, and I didn't notice it myself. We have till 10:30, so we have about 15 minutes, and the next seminar begins at 10:45, actually. So we have just a few more minutes in the front of your schedule, and on the overview, it's correct. And on the second page where it lists the specific time, that was somehow inadvertently gotten from 45 to 15. So
okay.
We have a few more minutes maybe for some questions
yeah.
and answers or if there's
or,
other...
Or just a break, because this stuff is heavy. I recognize this stuff. I could have gone a couple minutes more.
You could be
all,
sweating already.
All of you would have been ready for a root canal without anesthesia. I carry some pretty hefty tax volumes around the office. Most of the lawyers in the office, and they're a very sophisticated group, the highly specialized people, look at it and say it would put me to sleep to have to read that stuff. Fortunately, there are a few of us, you know, who kind of enjoy it. Any quick questions, please?
Yeah. I have a 501c3 foundation, and most of our contributions is to church-related schools, churches, development, etc. We don't take any salary from as managers of it. Would that be a conflict where it is who addresses schools? Who addresses?
No. No, the question basically is his foundation, for which he doesn't take any salary, contributes to the church. Far from being a conflict, that would in all likelihood entitle you to designation under 509A3 of the code as a support organization for a public charity. The church is deemed to be a public charity. 509A3 allows a subordinate organization to be a support organization for the church. You got to have one church official on your board in order to qualify for that, but that's doable. I don't see a conflict of interest there at all. Yes, please.
Is there any other provision for an organization other than getting a 501c3?
To be tax exempt? There are many provisions under 501c for tax exemption. Subsection 3 is the one having to do with public charities. So either that or you can be a church. You realize a church does not have to file a Form 1028? But you jolly well better be a church. Okay. Yes, please.
I was going to ask, you know, you see a lot of times on CNN or either Dateline, a lot of these mega television evangelists having $3 and $4 million homes. How is that not, what does the government think about that?
Private inurement is the term. These $3 and $4 million homes for people that take money in and give receipts for it, to my way of thinking, if it weren't at least arguably a church entity, there would have been a lot more trouble up till now. Up till now, we've seen where the government finally says that's enough is where we have racial discrimination, you know, as in Bob Jones. Oral Roberts, you, I think, had some problems tax-wise, if I'm not mistaken. So you can cross the line, but the regulations for churches, under it's a 7,000 series in the code, as I recall, are very, very strict. You can't investigate a church unless, and I think the code says, a very high or very senior IRS official, ergo probably the commissioner or a deputy, makes a determination there's probably a difficulty there. Then you can't investigate until you've given them prior written notice. Why? Because of the First Amendment. See? Now, the First Amendment is a net of liberty that sweeps very wide. Thank God it does. And it can draw in some barracudas occasionally along with the decent fish, you know. So I'm not characterizing any of those in that term, but all I'm saying is that you can misuse the concept of a church, and I think that's one reason why some of these excesses go on. To my way of thinking, they're obscene. How can you preach the gospel of a Lord who didn't even have a home and live like that? Doesn't make any sense to me. Yes, please, sir.
Could you just elaborate on the publishing you mentioned? Mm-hmm. Presbyterian Life Training.
All right. The question is, just elaborate a little bit on publishing, because that's what a lot of people do. You know, I've done some of it myself, you know. Couldn't find a publisher nutty enough to take my books, so I printed some of them myself, you know. And I just did it as for profit. You know, I just, I didn't even consider going the 501c3 route. But if you are an independent entity, exempt entity, and you're publishing books, what the service is looking for is what they call a facts and circumstances test. What are you publishing, number one? Who's the target audience? What is the volume of work you're turning out? Is what you publish directly related to the stated purposes of your charter? You're probably incorporated. Most of the time, these exempts are corporate form. And are you in any way appearing to compete with a private sector? See. Now, Presbyterian and Reformed was a huge publishing. Now, they publish Christianity Today. They published that journal. Very, very widespread, very multi-denominational. It got so big, the service finally said, look, you know, you're a baptized version of Random House, admit it, you know, and you're just not exempt anymore. So it's a facts and circumstances test, and the scale of your operation and the scope of it. How narrowly you focus to your exempt purposes. If your exempt organization is related to health, and you publish solely material related to that area of interest, your defense is much stronger than if you start deciding you're going to reprint long out-of-print versions of the life of Martin Luther. You know, this is just kind of a crude example, but it hopefully gives you a little feel for it. Yes, ma'am, please. And okay. You're a health ministry, but you want to grow blueberries on the side. and market those where? To the public. You're in the process now of, a competing public entity rather than nonprofit. Now, if your whole thing is blueberries, blueberries will save your life, if not your soul. And you sell them with that thought in mind. Queer, you might have an argument, but it's kind of getting close. As one of my law professors once said, you're skating in the water, you know. Yes, brother.
Is information an asset when you serve on a church board? Because then you know where the church is buying a piece of property, and you buy a piece of property beside it.
Insider trading. Why does that term come to mind? If you were a public corporation and your corporation was buying property, and as an inside board member you knew that was going to happen and you bought property next door, I would be very concerned. The analogy, what disturbs me is I can't draw a real analogy, distinction between the two. You're still profiting from inside information. The fact that the church is not a for-profit institution and you're not facing some of the insider trading issues of securities law may, you know, cut you some slack there. It's a good question, and it's one that I think probably the government's attorneys would have to wrestle with for a while, deciding whether it's anything they were concerned about. My hunch is probably not, but it could sure go the other way. Yes, brother.
My son is developing a for-profit corporation for cheap lab work. He's hunting for investors in his corporation. I'm wondering if a non-profit hospital corporation could invest in that, or whether that might offer some problems.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I'm going to repeat it for the sake of the tape. Can an exempt organization, tax-exempt, invest in for-profit stuff? The answer is yeah, they can. They can, and it's portfolio income. And certain types of portfolio income are defined by the code not to be unrelated business income. Certain sales of securities are, certain rents are also exempt from UBI. Royalties are exempt from UBI, except if they're debt financed. Now let me explain what I mean. You're a tax exempt entity. Can you have a for-profit subsidiary? That's kind of the question we're asking here. Yeah, you can. You can have a for-profit subsidiary. And the rents or royalties that come back from that are not unrelated business income. Unless you went into debt to acquire your interest. Debt-financed securities are, then the proceeds from them are unrelated business income. I think the theory being that you're acting too much like a commercial trader. You're kind of playing the margin, so to speak. So it's a very good question. The short answer, please understand that I've given you very short answers today. There are a lot of ramifications that if you're actually going to plunge into any of this stuff, you need to think through in a whole lot more depth today. So I will give you the caveat. You see, in the front of a lot of books, nothing said today was intended as legal advice. To get legal advice, you should see your lawyer. Okay? With that, it's almost 10:30. We got to stop. You folks have to have a break because this stuff even can finally wear me down. I'm amazed you folks have stayed awake for it. Thanks so much.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2007. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.